yesteryear.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend Singing Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
The nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent.
We now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, the concluding chapter of our Obler Omnibus. Here once again is Arch Obler.
The war came along, the big war, World War II, and I began to write plays before the war began and during the war. They were plays of the moment, and so unlike the old Arch Obler plays and Lights Out plays, they're interesting only historically, but not they don't hold up in terms of today, since they were talking about Hitler and Nazis and fascism. I did many of those plays. It was an exciting time because that same impact of emotion that radio drama evoked in these war plays resulted in alerting, for example, people who didn't feel that Hitler was much of a menace to the terrible menace of this charming paper hanger. Since we were never invaded or never have been invaded, it was very difficult for the American public to relate to something that was going on thousands of miles away unless they had someone in the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. And statistically, very few families had people in the Army's Air Force. Simply hard to believe, but it was true. So one had to use all of one's abilities to try to get people to relate to this horror that was going on. I started by writing Johnny Got His Gun, Dalton Trumbo's very effective book, an anti-war play with Jimmy Cagney. And then almost overnight it went to a play with Paul Muni, who was one of the great actors of our times, on board a carrier with the bombs falling, giving his viewpoint.
The happiness of children. This is the heritage of freedom and tolerance.
In the confusion that is today's Middle Europe, where hundreds and thousands of human beings are denied both the right to live in peace and the very means of sustaining life, there is no such happiness.
The tears of children. This is the heritage of the poisons of intolerance.
Why do they hate me? Mother, I'm hungry. Me.
But where can I go?
Innocent children caught in the whirlpool of inhuman hatred. Children ostracized, excluded from schools and public places, threatened with physical harm, forbidden the simplest requirements of spiritual survival. Surely our American sympathies go out to these, the most pitiful and helpless of sufferers.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Burgess Meredith.
For several years, there has been in progress a worldwide effort to facilitate the migration of these children. The terrible events of last November in Middle Europe turned this exodus into a panic. Thousands of helpless people mobbed consular offices pleading that their children be spared the fate that they themselves were unable to avoid. By long tradition, America has been a haven for the oppressed. Long before there was any thought of concerted action on this subject, hundreds of American families, moved by the examples of Holland and Great Britain, expressed a desire to take into their homes German, Catholic, Jewish, and Protestant refugees' children whose parents were willing to put their safety in their hands. Shortly after the convening of the present Congress, 50 of the country's outstanding Catholic and Protestant clergymen presented to the President of the United States a moving petition.
America must do its share in offering refuge to some of these children as a token of our sympathy and as a symbol of our faith in the ideals of human brotherhood.
Tonight, Miss Katharine Hepburn and Mr. Burgess Meredith from our nation's capital bring you two dramatic pictures of the plight of these refugee children, a problem which affects our conscience as a nation of human beings.
Sitting in the peace and quiet of your own home, safe in the blessings of a tolerant democracy, listen to the first of two plays. Mr. Burgess Meredith, in the role of the captain, in Sole Survivors.
The scene, aboard the U.S. patrol boat Liberty, somewhere in the North Sea. It is dusk. The usual disciplined calm of the ship has been broken for the past half hour by a minor tragedy of the sea. In the heavy fog, a small fishing skiff has been cut down by the lunging prow of the destroyer. At the moment, the senior officer is making his report to the young captain.
And there's no doubt, sir, from the testimony of the men on deck, that not only was the skiff operating without a foghorn, but she didn't have a light on her, neither fore nor aft.
It's all very well, Mr. Grogan. What I want to know is, how about the boy?
Oh, he's all right, sir. Got a thing wrong with him. Raising the devil good and proper, that he is, sir.
What do you mean?
Well, sir, it's a boat he wants.
A boat?
Aye, sir. The minute he hit the deck, he began yelling for a boat in place of the one we ran down.
Put him down below till morning.
Oh, but that won't help, sir. It's the baby that's got us worried.
A baby?
Aye, sir, a baby, sir. 10 or 12 months old is how I read it, sir.
Lieutenant, perhaps you're not aware that I saw the boy brought over the side. He was alone.
Yeah, aye, sir, but all the time he had this kid, I mean this baby, wrapped up snug under his coat.
There,
sir, do you hear him?
Send him in here.
Aye, sir.
Hey, you. You, boy. The commander will see you.
This is him, sir. I mean them.
Very good, Mr. Dolan.
Aye, sir.
Come closer, boy. Boy, can't you do something about that child?
The captain? You're the captain?
I'm Captain Kennedy. That baby, can't you do something about him?
She's my sister, Herr Captain.
Your sister? Well, you're carrying quite an armful. Why not sit down?
I must have a boat. Could you not stand him in here?
All right, that's enough about that. You'll be taken care of.
Then you will give me a boat? Well, now?
Try and understand, this is a government ship. Facts of your case will be placed before the proper authorities. I'm sure proper compensation will be made for your loss.
Hole in the ground.
What are you saying?
All that is left for us is a hole in the ground.
Where are you from?
Grunberg.
How about your family?
Family?
Mother, father.
They took my papa away. So my mother, she chose the ground.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Grunberg, about 200 miles from sea. How did you manage to, You don't mind my asking you a few questions, do you?
Questions, mein Herr? You ask me? No. I have questions I wanted to ask for many days.
What are you talking about?
You are older. They always tell me the old are wise. So now you tell me, Herr Captain.
Tell you what?
Herr Captain, why did they do it?
Well, it's a difference of ideas, my boy. Someday you'll understand.
Understand, mein Herr? What is there to understand? My papa was good. My mother was good. It was all good where we lived. The sun was so bright. The air so clear. Then all at once, nothing was good. They came in the night. Papa was gone. They chased me through the streets. Make me understand, mein Herr. Why all at once do they hate us? Why do they want us to be hungry, to have no place to go?
Well, I said it's a difference of ideas. I can't explain.
My papa told me many things. He talked to me of a world where men think free and talk free. Where everyone has his own land. Not too much. And men are like brothers. It is why my papa's gone, mein Herr. It is why my mother's dead.
Now, boy.
Listen to her, Herr Captain. Our village was full of such laughter. Where is it now? Only Anna and me. But I take away to some place where there's nobody old and wise to laugh at her when she's hungry.
So that's where you were sailing.
She's so little, mein Herr. See? So pretty. And she is afraid. She never cry. Just look at me like she say, Porter, you take good care of me. I will take care of her. I will. Give me a boat. Give me a boat. Give me a boat.
It's all right, son. It's all right. It'll be all right. It'll be all right. This is your boat.
Mine?
I'll take you to a place where, God willing, you and your sister will be safe.
You know such a place, mein Herr?
Yes. Because we're not so old. We're not so pompous. We're not so blind. Complacently foolish. It's to shut our eyes and our ears to the misery, to the reality of events. I mean that we haven't forgotten that liberty is not a gift, but a victory.
Look, mein Herr. She's gone to sleep, my sister.
Well, now you take her outside, son. The lieutenant will give you a place to sleep.
Danke, mein Herr. You're good.
It's all right, son.
I thought there was no one left who was good. Danke, mein Herr.
Boy, sleep well.
Radio room. Make the following addition to message sent to flagship, quote, in re-skiff rundown in fog, there were two survivors, a boy and a baby. We are proceeding on course.
We are taking children home.
Ladies and gentlemen, before a brilliant audience in our nation's capital and under the auspices of the Federal Councils of the Churches of Christ in America, we have just presented Mr. Burgess Meredith in the role of the captain and Jackie Kelk as the young boy in the first of two plays concerning the situation now troubling the conscience of men of good heart throughout the civilized world. The problem of making new homes and new lives for the innocent young victims of political oppression and intolerance.
And now for the second play, Miss Katharine Hepburn, in another original drama. Its title, Miss American.
The scene, a great luxury liner returning from Europe to America. It is late at night. A girl stands on the boat deck looking out into the darkness, her face to the wind that lifts white caps on the tumbling sea. Suddenly, an older woman approaches and speaks.
Well, Ronnie, I must say this is a peculiar way to behave.
What did you say, Aunt Mary?
I said it distinctly and you heard me. Do you realize that people have been asking about you?
Have they?
Oh, Ronnie, do come downstairs, standing up here in the cold.
Please, I'm all right.
Oh, Ronnie, what is the matter with you?
Poor people.
People? Oh, that. Well, after all, my dear, there are always a certain number of undesirables on board a ship this size. And if you'd only stop wandering up and down the second and third classes, you'd find everything quite right and proper.
Right and proper?
As for the children, I spoke to the captain about them.
Did you?
Staring at us every time we walked the deck. I told the captain exactly how we felt about the matter.
We?
The things we talked about this morning.
Oh, yes, I remember.
I should think you would. You were quite definite in your opinion. And of course, I agree with you. They've no right to take such young children and bring them to New York to heaven knows what. But you know the captain. That little charming smile, and he changed the subject, and... Oh, what difference does it really make? We'll be docking in the morning and away from all this.
Aunt Mary, there's something I want to tell you.
No, tell me later, my dear. Right now, the thing for you to do is to go down, get dressed, and join the others just as quickly as you can. Come now.
No. I want to stay here.
Why, Ronnie...
Please, a few moments longer. I'll come down.
Ronnie, I've never known you... Well, very well, have your silly little mood. But I don't understand what it's all about. Mooning up here in the dark like a romantic 16-year-old. All I say is hurry downstairs. We'll be waiting for you.
Romantic. Yes, it is romantic. I'm in love with her. If she knew. In love with... Yes. Love, a 23rd sight with...
America.
That's a childish thought to have.
Patriotic, Pap.
Of course it is. Of course. Getting softening of the brain. Thinking silly things. Over-emotionalized. Ought to go below and join the party. Stop standing here thinking to myself.
America.
No. No, why shouldn't I think it out? How did it start?
The things we talked about this morning.
Yes, Aunt Mary did say that. The things we talked about this morning.
Those children.
Always staring at us.
Why bring them over?
Full of foreign ideas. Always staring.
Not like us. Foreigners. Not like us.
Not like us. I said that, I remember. Not like us. Not like us. Not like me. Not like me. Resented their being on board. What happened? Oh, let me remember. I went walking on the lower deck. They were sitting there as usual.
The four of them.
Yes, the four of them. Sitting in a row. White faces staring. Eyes looking at me. At me. At me. I couldn't stand it. What did I say? Yes, I said.
You, children. Don't you know it's bad manners to stare at people?
For a moment, no answer. Three little boys, one little girl. Their staring eyes. Why should they stare at me? I said.
Answer me, one of you. If you're coming to America, heaven knows why, at least they should have taught you some English.
They didn't move. Four rigid little figures. And then...
We all speak English.
Well, at last, the thing speaks.
No, that is not my name.
He said that. Then he closed his mouth. And the four of them were sitting there once again. Those eyes of theirs, staring. I said...
What are you sitting there for? I've been watching you all through the trip. You sit there in those deck chairs hour after hour. What are you waiting for?
America.
She said that, the little one. And then she closed her mouth so tightly I could see the muscles of the corners of her lips. She sat there, tensed, frightened. Not another sound from any of them, their eyes beyond me on the sea, on the horizon. I said...
All right, you're waiting for us to reach land. But what's that got to do with the four of you getting up, running around, having fun? Come on! Don't you know how to laugh? You, do you know how?
Then we are in America. Then we will laugh.
So that's it. You don't like the sea. You're waiting for the land.
No, we are waiting for America.
Waiting for America? What silly nonsense were these children thinking? Couldn't laugh until America. I thought to myself how silly, brute these children, strangers, alien, foreign to our thoughts. Aloud, I said.
Listen, the four of you, are you trying to rid me in your infant continental manner? If you're waiting until you land, until you laugh, I'm warning you, you better start laughing now. There isn't much to laugh about there, let me assure you. The dullest, dumbest place on earth. Why do you think I went abroad? Laugh in America. Don't make me laugh. We've got depressions and recessions and concessions and dissensions and probes and investigations and this and that and depressions and investigations. And while I kept talking, the children's faces grew angrier and angrier. Their eyes larger and larger, hating me for what I was saying. Angrier and angrier until at last one of them cried out,
"No! No, wait.
Wait?
Miss American, wait. What you say, it is not right. America is good. And is a good place. Because, yeah, you say it. Because in America, all men are
created equal.
Yeah, and they are endowed by their creator with the right of life on liberty. On liberty. On the sort of happiness.
Bravo! Right out of the old Declaration of Independence. So where did you learn that? And what does it mean?
Young teachers.
Yeah, yes. Yes. Here on the board, they gave me a book. I read. How you say it, Miss American? I teach.
You teach? You? And what you teach, all that about life and liberty, what can it possibly mean to poor children like you?
Maybe I do not understand everything you say, Miss American, but what we learn, it means that no matter what is wrong in America, it can be fixed. We are free and equal, and we can work and help America.
Help America? When he said that, I didn't have anything more to say. Nothing cute or bright or clever. Four little children. I stood in front of them. Suddenly, I wanted to say so many things to them, but my throat, I couldn't until one of them said,
"Please, Miss American, what the book say about America? It is all right."
Right.
Tell us of it, Miss American.
Bitte.
Please.
America. It's very large and very beautiful. And all the people in it, or their fathers' fathers, came over the water to it, just the way you're doing. And there's a bigness to it, and a braveness to it. And you need never be afraid. And no matter what goes wrong there, there's always hope. As long as there's someone like you to remind the rest of us that the American way is the human way. That's what I said to them. Yes. And they came close to me and touched my hand. And they smiled at each other and at me. And so I'm in love. Yes, in love. With my country. For remembering four little people who want to help us.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we bring this program starring Katharine Hepburn and Burgess Meredith to a close. The broadcast was especially written for this occasion by Art Obler, who with Evan Roberts took part in the direction. The cast included Betty Kane, Jackie Grimes, May Grimes, Jackie Kelp, Adelaide Klein, Ed Latimer, Bobby Reddick, and George Wallach. The narrators were Dean Carlton, Lee Hillary, and speaking, Raymond Edward Johnson. The music was composed by Leif Stevens, who conducted the orchestra.
I came out to Smogville. Well, it wasn't Smogville in those days. It was blue sky, so blue that it was unbelievable. I came out here because I was asked to do a special series that originated on the Warner Brothers lot and that had Dick Powell as its leading man. It was a variety show. And I was to do a 7-minute drama complete in this variety show with famous stars. I remember that program with the music. I think it was called Hollywood All-Star Jamboree or something like that. I've forgotten. But what was the music about it was the fact that the second comedian on the show, and he was rather unimportant, was a fellow named Bob Hope, who after the broadcast would rush into the control room to a teletype machine and await the reaction of the sponsor who had a teletype in his office. He was the sponsor. He was the owner of Lucky Strike, a fellow named George Washington Hill. And this man, Hill, in New York, would teletype Mr. Hope what he thought of his jokes. And generally, he didn't like them. I did 7 minutes. Before I tell you about the 7 minutes and the fun I had with those, I remember the Hope face of those days, that every time that teletype would click a negative, it was as if he'd been hit across the face by one of his golf clubs. Quite a difference from the self-possessed Mr. Hope. My function, as I said, was to do a 7-minute drama with a famous star. And most of these stars had never done television. And since I was also supposed to direct them, I went through a special kind of a hell because I discovered that most motion picture stars were stars only because, well, how shall I put it delicately? If you shoot the hind end of a horse 40 times, eventually you'll get the right expression in one of those 40 times. And then you can paste it on the front end of the horse's picture and you'll get the front and back end. One of those actors who were a product of the editing room was Gary Cooper. He was a charming man, but in the dimension of radio, he was absolutely no good. He was getting $10,000. This seems to be the going sum, but he was getting $10,000 to do the little 7-minute bit. Now, $10,000 30 years ago is like getting $50,000 now. When they talk about peak salaries, those days, you know, few taxes, uninflated dollar. Well, at any rate, Mr. Cooper had never done radio up to that time. Nothing at all. But he couldn't resist, or his agent couldn't, the $10,000. My play was about a cowboy riding his horse on a western plain and thinking in his own manner about his world. And again, I may overuse this expression, but I did write it from my heart. The sponsor was elated when he read it. The agency was elated, but Mr. Cooper looked at the script and then got in front of the microphone and read it in this manner. Well, I think that the West is going to change. I died. The more I rehearsed him, the worse he got. Finally, I took him off in a corner just before we went on the air. And I tried to explain to him that in radio, the listener was as close to him, Cooper, as the microphone. That their ears were right next to him, so he should talk quietly, confidentially, and not read, but sort of tell them the story. I said, you know the script, Coop. You know it well enough so that you don't have to read it. Put in your own words, but talk to them. Don't read. He got on the air, and he was... Well, before he got on the air, when I got through with my little directorial peroration, he stretched his long length, and I said, Mr. Cooper, did you understand? And he said, yep. He said, you know, I've been sitting here thinking. Now, if I raised the sight on that new gun I got, I bet I could get 50 yards. He hadn't even paid attention to me, thinking about his guns. But I got my revenge. See, he went on the air, and he did my sketch badly. And then right after that, one of the reasons he got the $10,000, he was going to give a testimonial to Lucky Strike. So we got through with the play, the music hit up and down, and then he said, Lucky Strikes are good to my throat. And since this was live radio, it couldn't be changed. You can imagine that teletype machine. Smoke rose from it when George Washington Hill heard his $10,000 going down the drain. And I sat and gloated at all the advertising men around because they said, don't worry about Mr. Cooper. He'll do well by you and by us. I have another fond memory, speaking of adventures in front of the microphone. Charles Laughton was a truly great actor. Those of you who were too young to have seen him, and they don't do many of his movies on late for some reason, but he had a magic about him. But he was the original method actor. Now, those of you who don't know about Stanislavski and the method, I will simply say that Marlon Brando scratching himself is a method actor. They're realistic actors, so to speak. Well, Mr. Laughton was one of those, and I was doing The Flying Yorkshire with him. The Flying Yorkshireman, rather, is a story about a little old Yorkshireman who suddenly discovers he can fly. It far predated the Flying Nun, I assure you. We were just about ready to go on the air. Just a few minutes to go, and mind you, in those days there was no delay. You went on the air when that little red line came up in the same manner as in today's television. No matter what's on the screen, when that time for that commercial comes up, they break right in, even if it's in the middle of the most marvelous scene of passion or the second coming of the Jesus. Well, in those days, the same thing was true, that you had to get on the air. Suddenly, Laughton is waving at me, and I came out running out of the control room. He said, Arch, old boy, he was British, I don't feel the sense of flying. I can't go on the air. I can't do it. I don't feel the sense of flying. Well, to be a director, one has to be prepared for anything. You know, if you ask the Red Sea to part and the Red Sea doesn't part, you've got to have your own pail of water around. I ran over and grabbed one of the huge fans, because in those days, the air conditioning wasn't what it is today, and I shoved that tremendous propeller right up against Mr. Lawton's mouth, hit the switch. The blast of air practically knocked him down, and as he choked trying to get some air, he was saying, I got it, I got it, and he went on the air. We had lots of excitement in those early days of live radio, just as the old television people feel that the days of live television were the best. But I must say that when we went on records and then on tape, it wasn't so bad either, because the wonder was still there. The theater of your own mind.
From Hollywood, California, Autolite brings you Everything for the Boys, the Command Theater of the Air, starring Mr. Ronald Coleman. Because of the vital significance of tonight's play, this living book, based upon the Bible, the Electric Autolite Company has foregone its usual commercial messages.
Thank you. this. How many ages and generations have brooded and wept and agonized over this book? What untellable joys and ecstasies. What support to martyrs at the stake. To what myriads has it been the shore and rock of safety? The refuge from driving tempests and wreck. Of its thousands, there is not a verse, not a word, but is thick studded with human emotion.
In this time of the testing of human values, the book is a part of the undercurrent of life, a stream of cultural treasure linking the past with the life stream of each man of decency. Turn your thoughts, you who listen, away from yourself for these moments, and listen to the book as it lives. Created the heaven and earth, and the earth was without form and void, and the darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness.
Boy, Joe, didn't I tell you?
Joe, ain't you glad?
I don't know.
What's the matter with you?
Yes. If I say it to you, I won't say it to her, and it's better that way. I didn't want this kid, Fred. I didn't want it because every time I felt my empty sleeve and then read the headlines, I said to myself, no kid, no kid. Let the world go to the devil where it belongs. 1920 war, only over 2 years, and already they've forgotten all the fine words that sent me over there. Already they're grabbing and conniving and cheating. I better go see her. And him.
Yeah. Joe. Joe, listen. What you just said, but... Well, think of this. When a baby's born, maybe... Maybe it's like a new day.
And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth. Both man and beast and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air. For it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a just man, and Noah walked with God. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make thee an ark. Thus did Noah. According to all that God commanded him, so did he. And the Lord said unto Noah, come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation.
Look at the wind of all the sails. Oh, it's
best boat in the world, isn't it, Pop?
All right, son. Come ahead. Your mother's waiting lunch.
Okay, Pop. Pop, why haven't we got a big boat?
Well, I guess it's because we haven't enough money.
But everybody's got lots of money now.
Really? Who told you that?
Teacher.
Yes, I suppose. Someday, 1929 may be considered the golden year.
Gentleman in the audience who just spoke, state his name.
John Eli Adams.
John Eli Adams. Yes, we were quite sure it wasn't Quincy. I've just been informed that you're a member of the sophomore class. Please, please, gentlemen, let's hear what Johnny Adams has to say. May throw light upon certain opinions, fortunately very much in the minority on this campus. Enlighten us, Mr. Adams. Please, enlighten us.
Well, this is called the University Conference for Peace in our time. But I always thought that in order to have a peace conference, all the combatants had to be present. Where are they? How can you talk of peace in our time if the beast isn't here? That's our only antagonist. Do I have to tell you about it? It's the beast that calls itself blonde but has many colors and many faces. And one of them is cowardice. And the other one is the selfishness of the child-minded. You're talking no war now. But what you're really saying is, I'm 18 or 19 or 20, so don't damage this world in any way that'll cheat me of what I want. But I tell you, gentlemen, the cost of peace in your time is too much for even you or me to pay. How dare we, the young, expect peace in our time when there is no peace in the world?
How soon will we be there?
Half an hour.
Does he know we're coming?
Mm-hmm. Why are you afraid?
I just am.
Of me?
No.
Tell me.
All right. Remember when you told them off?
Told who off?
It was 2 years ago at school, that peace at any price meeting.
What's that got to do with...
I fell in love with you then.
What?
I loved you then because you were like one of the prophets of old. You said what you believed. And you said it not caring what happened to you.
Oh, hey, now, wait a minute.
No, I want you to hear this. In a little while, we'll be together. All right? But how about after that?
What kind of talk is that? Always.
You want to, and I want to. But will they let us?
Say, what's this merry-go-round?
Tonight's headlines. You showed them to me yourself.
Oh.
Today, Poland. What about us? Tell me, John.
I love you very much.
Tell me.
There might have been an answer a few years ago if somebody had done something about fascism and company then. But they didn't. All we can do now is wait.
But I want to know that you'll be with me.
War or peace, either way, there's no answer to that.
Righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with thee.
Yet let me talk with thee of thy judgments. Wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? Wherefore are all they happy that deal very treacherously? Thou hast planted them, yea, they have taken root. They grow, yea, they bring forth fruit. Thou art near in their mouth and far from their reins. But thou, O Lord, knowest me. Thou hast seen me and tried mine heart toward thee. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter, and prepare them for the day of slaughter. How long shall the land mourn, and the herbs of every field wither, for the wickedness of them that dwell therein?
Sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk. I've been afraid to. Now I want to.
Okay, let's stop calling him Snooks. Let's call him David. David Adams.
About you, John.
Do you really want me to?
Yes.
All right. I wake up in the morning. I work, I eat, I sleep. Once in a while I read, we go to the movies, love, everything's the same. And yet it's as if it wasn't happening. I mean, really, anymore. With every day, it's less and less real. The only things real are the newspaper headlines, the news broadcasts, but not our lives, not here, not anywhere in America. I get this crazy thought. We're dead and we're waiting for the fascists to come over here and bury us.
No, I guess I was holding him too tight. I'm sorry, honey. Sleep, baby, just sleep.
Well, you wanted me to talk.
Yes, John, I wanted you to. John, of course I've known what's been wrong.
Have you?
For the last few years, you've been thinking and suffering. Because you've understood how everything the Germans have done has been part of a terrible plan.
All right, so I'm smart, so what good has it done?
No, you're asking what good have you done. That's what's wrong with you, John. You reach the end of just thinking and suffering inside of yourself for people.
I think to myself, what if we never wake up? What if the fools went out here and I never get a chance to fight? Vicky, that's killing me. What if I never get the chance to fight?
Take it now.
What?
Do what you want to. Now.
How can I?
The baby? Me?
Yes.
I married you for what you were and for what you're going to be. Maybe this is what you're going to be.
You couldn't get along.
I will.
Vicky.
Your lips.
Oh, Vicky. Augustine. All right, all right.
What? Mr. Adams. Mr. Adams, your radio on?
No. Well,
I heard it. I think I just heard it. The Japs, they're bombing us someplace. Does that mean we're in the war?
John.
All right, Chaplain.
The men?
Oh, a few seasick, but they'll be all right, sir.
Been waiting a long time for this.
Yes, sir.
The first invasion barge to get to the continent. Well, that'll be all right, eh, Captain?
Right, sir.
You're married, aren't you, John?
Oh, yes, sir.
And of course. You showed me a picture of your wife and child. Strange. Ever since we started over the channel, all I can remember is something from the book. It's something I used to say to myself back in the days when I doubted whether America would ever wake up to the fight. I've trodden the wine press alone, and of the people, there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment, for the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. And I looked, and there was none to help.
And I wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore, mine own arm brought salvation to me. And my fury, it upheld me.
You said it too.
Yes.
And now the greatest crusade of men in history.
I'd call it a prayer.
I don't...
This quite... whole invasion, Chaplain, it is a prayer. A prayer and a promise. A prayer to God to help us destroy the evil. And a promise to God that once it is destroyed, we'll never let it happen again. I saw a paper from home. There are people saying that the peace is already lost. That what we win will be destroyed by selfish groups of selfish men. I can't believe that. I won't believe it. I have faith, Chaplain, in people, in the living God that's in them.
One more minute, men.
Oh, boys, now. This is it. I've thought of this minute.
I have too.
Chaplain, sir, will you pray for us?
Yes, of course, soldier. No, John, you say it.
I? Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done.
Trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory.
Gentlemen, you have just heard This Living Book, written and directed by Arch Obler. Ronald Coleman was the narrator. The boy was Robert Bailey. The girl, Mercedes McCambridge. The original music was composed and directed by Gordon Jenkins.
It's curious that when television came along, there were many people who said that radio drama would live concomitant to television. I felt otherwise. Just about that time, I put out a book of my plays called Obler Omnibus. Curious enough, it's just come out in reprint this last few weeks. And at the tail end of it, I gave a sort of a requiem to radio. I'd like to read you just a couple of paragraphs. They're interesting historically. Now, mind you, this book of collected radio plays was written in 1945. And at that time, television wasn't terribly important. As some of you may remember, the size of the tube was very small, and it was mostly local of programs, aspiring singers and all that sort of thing. But I looked in the future and I wrote, I end with a requiem for radio, a requiem written by a moving pencil of electronic rays converging from a cathode tube. Television will eventually supplant blind broadcasting, even as sound pictures did with the silent movies. To deny this is to whistle in the dark of wish thinking. Naturally, in the early years of television, one-dimensional radio will operate vigorously. But as the techniques of the televisor work out and as equipment improves, our present-day form of broadcasting will walk further along in its own funeral procession. I was wrong because, as you know, you're listening to radio now. But I was right in this sense that never again would we have the tremendous array, the tremendous variety of the Fibber McGee and Molly and the Lux Radio Theater and the Amos and Andy and all the other sorts of varying programming. I was wrong there, of course, but here's a place where I was right. I said, but with television, the visual factor will become the predominant one. The listener will see only what he sees, and so broadcasting will lose a great deal of its image-arousing quality and become visually factual, a composite of the theater and the talking pictures. No longer will the listener participate completely imaginatively. The broadcast will be delivered to the audience on the platter of the televisor screen, and once again, as with sound motion pictures, the magic of self-projection and participation will be largely gone. Once again, the listener will become primarily a passive spectator. And you who are listening, who've been watching television, say last night, you sure were passive, weren't you? Except when you got up and went to the icebox. What was radio? What is radio? What is the future of radio? I know this, that radio drama still has its impact. Those of you who have been listening to this series of programs knows the truth of that. It still has the ability to arouse, to emotionalize, to an extent unparalleled in any other medium. To you who have a large ear toward radio, do a little praying that radio drama will come back. The things that radio drama could say are important. The things that we'd like to hear are necessary. But while look back, there's futures of entertainment that we haven't even started to plumb. For example, when television goes three-dimensional, as it will, there'll be wonders that will make all of us forget the bad of television and the loss of radio, radio drama. But if we don't blow our universe apart, if we've got the good sense not to fission and fusion ourselves, that will be the beginning of a new wonder of entertainment and of instruction and of amusement and of actuality that will make everything that went before as different as and as meaningless as if a ghost had passed by. So as we look back at old radio, let's look into the future. One that can be truly wonderful, and I hope one of real peace.
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Be with us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
And now it's just about time we were picking up our memories and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them, as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eyes peeled, yes, sir, looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. Until then, this is your old friend, Singin' Sam, saying goodbye for now.
Same Time, Same Station is produced for KRLA News and Public Affairs by John Price. Associate producer Cam Currier. Special research by Martin Halperin. Our thanks to Arch Obler for his time and for the original transcriptions used in many of our program rebroadcasts during the past 3 weeks.
Be sure to be with us next week at this same time, same station.